Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 15. Police questioned Jeff Weintraub and me for so long, they could have written a book about him stealing that goat and me finding it. Although it did require a tremendous amount of concentration, I do believe I succeeded in giving the same answers to the same questions posed different ways, which I found preferable to telling the whole truth at that particular time. Eventually, Trooper Igor snapped his notebook shut and said something about statements in headquarters, which I assumed meant they were all going to go away and I could eat my dinner and go to bed. But then McCarthy said something about my riding with him, which I didn't like the sound of at all. I liked it even less when I actually sat in his sporty little car beside him. "Why in the bloody hell didn't you stay home and let me handle this like I told you 100 bloody times?" he ranted, before we even cleared the driveway. However, I expected him to say that, so I easily ignored him. After what seemed like an endlessly long drive, we arrived at the state police headquarters, a nondescript brick building I'd never noticed before set back from the main road, about 12 miles north of Somerset. I did what I was told, and evidently did it right, because eventually the officers thanked me and told me I could go. Once back outside in the parking lot, I breathed in the fresh air and gave thanks that that particular ordeal was over. "I'll send someone to pick up the goat first thing tomorrow morning." McCarthy's voice interrupted my thoughts about police officers and how kind and wonderful they all are. "What?" At first, I had no idea what he was talking about, but then I recalled one rather crucial detail I'd neglected to tell him. "I said, I'll send someone to your place to pick up the goat first thing tomorrow morning. I assume you can keep it until then?" "I don't have it. Her," I replied, scanning the parking lot. "Why isn't there ever a damn cop around when you need one?" "What?" I thought he was going to rip the door right off the car. "Then where in the bloody hell is it?" "Not it. Her, McCarthy." I calmly corrected him once I ascertained that all 10 of his fingers were safely embedded in the molding around the door. "She's your goat. You wanted her, so I put her at your place."
"You did what?"
He let go of the door and loomed over me like a vulture about to swoop down on fresh roadkill.
"Calm down, McCarthy," I murmured in my best mad dog soothing tone. "She's perfectly fine. I'm sure she's quite safe."
"B-b-b-b-how?" He sputtered and ran his hand through his hair several times in rapid succession. "You left your key at my place, remember?" I reminded him of this in a manner I felt clearly communicated. He did this because he subconsciously wanted me to put the goat in his apartment.
"Get in the car," he snarled, completely missing my point.
As he drove, I filled him in on what I considered the salient details. "I figured I might as well take her there and return your key at the same time," I reported briskly. "Save you a trip."
"Where did you put it?"
"Her." He took his eyes off the road long enough to glower at me.
"Honestly, McCarthy, in the bathroom. Where else would you keep a goat in an apartment?"
From the way he almost wrenched the wheel off the steering column, I gathered this wasn't as obvious to him as it was to me.
"Why in the hell didn't you put it, her, in that bloody shed of yours?" he growled through gritted teeth.
"Because she's not my goat."
"Well, she's not my bloody goat either," he bellowed. "Look, you pompous son of a bitch," I could feel my curls bouncing crazily as I shouted at him. Weintraub saw me at Monica's cottage, and for all I know, he saw me collecting those samples, bashed me on the head, went after me with a knife, and stole the samples from my refrigerator. If you think I was going to put that goat in my shed so he could find her there, you must be a lot dumber than I thought.
MacArthur remained silent for a long time, during which he slowly relaxed his grip on the wheel, much to my relief. I couldn't shake the feeling that he was pretending it was my neck.
"You did the right thing. More or less," he finally conceded. "I'll take you home."
His civilized response cut me completely off guard, and I automatically responded as another civilized person would.
"Since we're already closer to your place than mine, why don't we go to your place and see how she's doing?" I suggested.
"And I guess I could take her home, too, if you want, since you don't act like you know much about goats. Now that Weintraub's out of the picture, there's nothing to worry about."
I threw in that last comment to see how he'd react. When he didn't react at all, I wanted to feel relieved, but wasn't sure I could.
When we pulled up in front of MacArthur's building, I turned to him. "Just remember that's a goat in your bathroom, not a famous mystery writer," I informed him. This seemed like the safest way to tell him that maybe the goat's manners weren't quite as good as his. I thought that would give me enough leeway, considering his manners weren't all that good.
"Is there anything else I should know about that goat?"
He gave me the very blue-eyed skewer routine as we entered his apartment building. I was about to explain that goats sometimes ate things that even a marginally mannered writer with minimal gastronomic requirements might not, when an ancient Amazon suddenly bore down on us, wearing a see-through black blouse, a red bra that struggled vainly to hold up huge breasts that sagged like geriatric elephant testicles, and gold lamé stretch pants so tight even the most paranoid agent from the Department of Homeland Security would be convinced she wasn't hiding anything.
"Oh, there you are, dear Dr. MacArthur," she beamed at him.
"I thought I heard strange noises coming from your place and knocked, but you weren't home, were you?"
"Of course not, because here you are, right here. So that explains it, doesn't it?"
Then she turned and thrust her face within inches of mine and shouted, "I'm Bubbles Lamar, the landlady." I knew my mouth was hanging open, but I couldn't help it. Bubbles Lamar wore more makeup than I owned and probably ever would in my lifetime. What few strands remained of her dyed hair stuck out of her head like frazzled orange antennae, seeking input from some long-dead planet. Whenever she laughed, which she did often, although for no reason I could discern, her tongue wetly smacked her lacquered lips and her bright beady eyes disappeared into a maze of deep skin folds, making her look like a bulldog with serious skin problems. That impression gained more credibility when I tentatively extended my hand in greeting, and she seized it with such enthusiasm I feared she'd eat it. Fortunately, somewhere in the building, a phone rang. She flung my hand aside like an old bone and teetered down the hall on her 3-inch spike heels, shrieking, "I'm coming! I'm coming!"
"Is she always like that?" I asked MacArthur as I checked to make sure I still had all of my fingers.
"So far," he muttered as he unlocked his door. "I haven't been here during a full moon yet." As soon as we entered the apartment, I insisted on checking the goat myself. I told MacArthur I needed to do this to avoid unnecessarily traumatizing the poor creature, but in reality I wanted to assess the damage. Once I slipped into the bathroom, I shut the door firmly behind me.
"Holy haystack, did you ever make yourself at home?"
I softly chided the small ruminant as I surveyed the room. I considered straightening things up, decided it was useless, and returned to the living room where I found MacArthur uncomfortably straddling a baby blue beanbag chair in a manner reminiscent of a great blue heron hatching a dinosaur egg.
"You have more, I presume?"
I smiled apologetically as I held up a mutilated roll of toilet tissue. He lowered the newspaper and studied the roll carefully.
"That's it?"
"Not exactly."
"What does not exactly mean, Dr. Upton?"
He struggled to get up, no doubt, so he could glare down at me. Sadly for him, but luckily for me, the beanbag oozed around him and he wound up flapping about instead. I took advantage of this opportunity to share a few other details with him. She ate, well, not really ate, sort of gnawed on your washcloth and towel a little, but I'm afraid the shower curtain's a complete loss. I ticked off the damage as he floundered helplessly. He let out a string of curses that lost much of their effect when he had to roll out of the beanbag and onto the floor in order to right himself. However, by the time he retrieved his newspapers and his dignity, he appeared well on his way toward a full-blown snit. "You want me to take her home with me?" I volunteered again in an attempt to distract him. "Of course I do!" he shouted. "Fine," I shrugged. "I didn't know if you wanted to put a goat in your car." As I expected, that did distract him. "It's a rental," he mumbled vaguely. "Well, make up your mind," I prodded him crisply. "I'd like to get home. It's been a long day." "Show me the goat and tell me what to do," he sighed. "No need to see her," I replied glibly. "I'll just tell you. Show me the damn goat." I gestured toward the bathroom. "Be my guest," I smiled cordially, but had to summon all of my quality upbringing to resist the urge to kick his British behind as he strode by. "Good Lord, you filled up the bloody room with hay," he roared mere seconds later. "Straw," I corrected him. I didn't want her hose to dent your floor. "The hay's in the bathtub. The rest of the bale's in your bedroom, in the corner, next to the ballerinas." I started to explain the basics of small ruminant husbandry and behavior, but the strange croaking noise he made when he saw the shredded shower curtain interrupted me. "Don't worry about it," I consoled him, snatching a fragment of pea-green, bubble-decorated vinyl from the goat's mouth. "I'm sure you can replace it." I shoved him out of the bathroom and turned off the light. "She needs her sleep," I explained, shutting the door firmly and ignoring the very awake goat noises coming from the other side. "She's very valuable." I then rattled off the basics of goat care, which McCarthy wrote down as if I disclosed a secret formula for cold fusion. Then he took me home, although he made it perfectly clear throughout the entire drive that he wanted me to stay at his place while he checked into a goat-free motel somewhere. I resisted his numerous attempts to browbeat me into doing this, thanked him for the ride home, then hummed cheerfully to myself as I watched his car disappear down the driveway. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.